we found that discipline was a lot more lenient amongst the air crew, amongst the air people. I guess, the way they explained it was that they had to have a lot closer relationship with the air crews, because the pilots and the observers depended on the air crew to keep the aircraft in good shape and so on, and they were a pretty close-knit crew and had to be.
Mm-hmm. I imagine it would be an alternative.
It resulted in people calling them by their first names and that sort of thing, and discipline naturally goes down the drain.
And I guess in the Navy, of course, something like that is unheard of.
Absolutely, yeah.
That would be, I guess, also a direct result or indirect result of the fact that getting back to the shipboard discipline when you're on board a confined space, whether mm-hmm. it's a PT boat or an aircraft carrier, you have to maintain a certain level of discipline, otherwise,
right,
as a fighting unit, I guess you're basically useless. Mm-hmm. In the air branch of the Navy, I imagine flags are kind of useless for communication. Did you have to, switch over to electrical or radio?
I was in the visual communication branch,
mm-hmm.
and in 1948 or 49, in there somewhere, we all had to take a course in the opposite side of communications. That is, the wireless people had to take a course in visual communications, and the visual people had to take a course in wireless. So we had to learn to read Morse at 22 words a minute. And
was
take
that
a
your first experience with wireless, or you had some basic knowledge of it prior?
No, we hadn't had any little exposure to it, but no training in it, no.
Mm-hmm. Did it present any difficulty?
Of course, we still used the same code,
right.
Whether it was visual, whether it was a lamp or a key. So it wasn't that much of a transition.
Right. In 1952, as you mentioned a few moments ago, you did attend the Junior Officer Leadership Training Course in Halifax again. Just the very title there sort of implies that they are training people for senior positions of command for leadership, but is that fairly close?
Well, and it's a method of giving them a more general training in all of the different branches. You advance in all the different branches and you take advanced training in all the different branches, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
So that you're better prepared to be a general service officer.
Would that include the more perhaps psychological aspects of what it would take to actually be a leader of men?
Yes.
That time, or just shortly thereafter, you were promoted to the rank of lieutenant and became the head of signal school in Halifax. And as much as St. Hyacinth at this time was no longer operational, that being a wartime base strictly. As the head of signal school, I'm just curious, now we're into the early 50s, the Cold War is starting to gather a fair amount of momentum. What about, I'm curious about Soviet or other East Bloc activities as far as eavesdropping, we'll say, or spying. Did you have to be cognizant of security as far as making sure that codes and signals and whatnot were hopefully unbreakable, or at least what type of precautions?
Oh yes, we were still we were using secure codes for all of our transatlantic communications, mm-hmm. trans-Pacific communications. We weren't really concerned about the Russians as the general public is led to believe.
Is that right? Yeah, I suppose despite the fact that the Cold War was.
Of course, we knew there were. Submarines observing what went on the coast, and there were Soviet fishing boats off the Atlantic coast which were serving two purposes, you know.
Just fishing for
God. Yeah.
I guess at the time.
So we had listening stations along the coast for listening for submarines for foreign submarines, whether they were Russian or what they were.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't keep calling them Russians as they do now, you know. It's pretty ridiculous the way they talk about them now.
In what respect?
Well, as if, you know, as it's well, I think they give the Russians credit for being a lot more antagonistic than they really are.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine, of course, in those days too, despite the Cold War tension, the West, Britain, United States, Canada, especially between the three of them put together, I mean, they were pretty superior in terms of technology and numbers to the Soviets. But I imagine that the Soviet sorties under the East Coast of their submarines would be a pretty, not exactly an everyday occurrence.
Well, I don't know. I think they had submarines stationed out there fairly regularly because they had mother ships, you know, that would service them.
At that time, they regarded within the military, you know, in the media, there's always a big deal, but within the military circles, were they really regarded as much of a threat in those days?
Well, we realized that they bore watching.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I don't think anybody was too upset about it. Americans tend to become upset rather easily.
After your stint in Halifax at the head of signal school, you went to Hamilton as staff officer for communications, which Hamilton being the headquarters for the Naval Reserves at the time. I'm curious as to why Hamilton as the headquarters for Naval Reserves?
Well, I think the idea was to get away from Naval Service Headquarters in Ottawa and remain as a separate entity,
mm-hmm.
because the reserves were a separate entity, and they liked to think of themselves being governed from a separate city, I guess.
They're a little hierarchy, a little kingdom. What about the rate here of promotion in the post-war period? Obviously, during wartime, because of attrition rate, put it politely, advancement would come relatively more quickly than in the peacetime. How about in the Canadian Navy during these years? What's
That certainly applied. Promotion during the war was pretty rapid.
Mm-hmm.
And slowed down immediately after the war, of course. There are certain ranks that are automatically, that a person is automatically promoted to after you've been in so many years. But then once you get up to beyond lieutenant commander, promotion is done on mainly on your performance and your track record, qualifications. But it was pretty good. We had people that we've had admirals on the coast here that joined up as midshipmen in 1946, and several of them have been rear admirals and vice admirals since then.
Were you satisfied with the point things were going for you personally?
Oh, yeah.
Or you were?
Sure.
The time in Hamilton, you were there for approximately 2 years. And we're talking about 1956 to the early 58, at which time, once again, you returned to your home away from home in Halifax to the HMCS Sioux, which is again a destroyer. At this point, was the Canadian Navy beginning to evolve primarily? Has it begun its transition into today? It is strictly anti-submarine warfare. That's all it's except for. In those days, were you beginning that transition in those days to just strictly anti-submarine duties?
Pretty well.
How about the, again, we're talking about the late 50s here, technology is becoming somewhat more sophisticated during the wartime. What would be the greatest change? change, we'll say, since the war until this time here, as far as hunting submarines?
Well, bringing out new destroyers that were computer equipped and with modern equipment, modern armament, and that was the main change.
How about in your field, in communications? Were the computers beginning to have an effect in the communications field at all?
Well, they had more sophisticated equipment in the way of radio teletype, and mm-hmm. and built-in coding systems and so on.
Mm-hmm. Would that thinking in terms of the Allied navies under NATO, was the equipment, or was there any sort of attempt at standardization so that communication would be more easily facilitated, or did each navy more or less go a separate way as far as type of equipment?
No, NATO pretty well ruled the roost and laid down the rules for communications, mm-hmm. so that we had common publications, you know, to use.
You remained with the Sioux for approximately 2 years, and in 1960 you were promoted to the rank of lieutenant commander, at which time you became the CEO of HMCS Alvaro Lake in Dartmouth, which again was a communications center. And that was not just strictly a Royal Canadian Navy. There was links with other countries, was there not? But it was part of a larger network.
That's right. Our main function was to communicate with, to receive and transmit communications to the Admiralty in England, mm-hmm. and to Australia, New Zealand. And we were closely linked with the States, of course, as well. But the main broadcasts, we put out main broadcasts from our station to the ships at sea, and then, which they read every day, you know, mm-hmm. keep them updated on what was going on.
Again, you would have to be, I would imagine, fairly aware, of course, now we're talking a decade or so after your stint in the Signal School in Halifax. Again, I would imagine more so at this point, you'd have to be cognizant of Soviet attempts to eavesdrop. What would be the routine there? Would the codes be changed daily, weekly, monthly? What would be some of the measures they would take to prevent electronic eavesdropping?
Well, it was mainly our communications by this time were pretty well all automatic. You know, we would receive radio teletype broadcasts from the Admiralty. And we would receive it on a coding machine, mm-hmm. which would unscramble it. And well, this was all done automatically.
This was
pretty foolproof as far as interception is concerned.
So we're talking about this, the beginning, I guess, of sort of the high-speed computer sports or what?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I guess even in those days, it would be, as you say, virtually impossible to intercept and dissect and decipher such codes. You remained at Alvaro Park for, I guess, approximately 4.5 years until 1965, at which point you left the Navy. I'm just wondering, in as much as by that time the White Paper on Defense had come out in 1964, Mr. Hellyer had more or less put forth his blueprint for Canadian forces as far as integration and, I guess, ultimately unification. And it's interesting that, as you said a little while ago, you were looking at the Navy as a post-war career. You got out within 15 years of the end of the war. I'm just wondering, how much of a bearing on your decision to leave was the turmoil, or the beginning of the turmoil of those days as far as the integration?
Well, there were two things that had a bearing on my leaving. One was the fact that I could see the writing on the wall as far as unification was concerned. They were talking about common uniforms and a lot of other garbage. And
I think that more or less puts your position in perspective.
Besides that, I had a family of six children dependent on me, and I knew that I was going to have difficulty getting a job outside of the Navy because of my background, you know, the communications and being a general officer at sea doesn't really train you to do a great deal
even
on civvy street other than administration.
Even with your experience, and as we say, we were talking about the fact that the computers were starting to come in, and you would obviously have a fairly extensive experience with some fairly sophisticated equipment, which I would imagine would
be able
anything in civilian.
No, that was handled by the technical officers. They had quite an extensive technical department, and we weren't required to handle computers at all.
Yeah.
So I didn't have that background.
Only administrative,
just strictly administrative.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that it was going to be difficult getting a job because there were a lot of people in line to get out of the service, and I didn't have to get out when I did. I could have stayed another year or a year and a half. But I was able to resign and get out without any penalty to my pension.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a consideration. And while I was still in the service, I applied for a job with the government, a communications job, which I was equipped for, and was successful in getting it. And after I accepted the job in Ottawa, I resigned from the Navy. But it was a case of, I knew that my pension wasn't going to be large enough to support six children getting ready for high school and university. So that had a strong bearing on my decision.
Do you think, in retrospect, had the integration and unification process not come up and they were going to continue on as they had, would you probably remain?
No, I don't think so. No, the other was the stronger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, survival was the
stronger. Yeah. Do you think, looking back on that time, there was tremendous upheaval, especially in the three forces, not so much in 1965, a little bit later on, but in your opinion, did the decisions taken at that time have a large bearing or great influence on the decision of many people who eventually did quit?
I think so. You know, there were a lot of officers that got out at that time.
And very senior ones.
Yes, and a good number of people in the lower deck as well that became disillusioned with the Navy.
How would the integration, unification, how would that process have affected, we'll say, communications? Would it be mostly
from
administrative, or did you try to amalgamate the administrative
ends
of things?
Yes, they did that. The station that I was in, the radio station that I had, we were just in the process of building a new radio station, which was completed after I left.
Mm-hmm.
But it became a combined radio station, manned by the different services. Basically still Navy, but there were a few other services come into it as well.
And I guess that would...
Of course, the same thing happened on the ships.
Sure.
There were a few Army people sent to ships to look after stores and that sort of thing, where it wasn't too much of a change for them.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as going, you know, as seagoing people were concerned, it was still handled by the Navy.
Just pursue it a little bit farther because it's sort of an area that's sort of personal interest. With respect to the actual fighting capabilities of the Navy, I know, for instance, within the Army, one of the consequences was that many famous regiments were disbanded and famous names and whatnot were dropped. I think today, I think we have the only Royal Canadian Regiment and like Queensland Rifles or whatever. In the Navy, I guess one of the major insults would be ultimately the loss of the traditional uniform.
That's right.
And
of course, the same thing applied with everybody. Everybody went into the same uniform, and they, you know, the pride of pride of the unit was very, very strong in all three services.
Sure.
And that was the most damaging factor, I think.
You take that up. Mm-hmm. Could you see at the time, too, the effect of, because I guess of the three services, the Navy is probably suffered the most of the three, until today we sort of quite reduced the shadow of what it once was. Could you see at the time, too, what this would result in terms of budgets and whatnot, and reduced budgets for shipbuilding and whatnot? I mean, I guess the whole overall picture just was, for someone such as yourself, just was not particularly enticing.
No, that's true. Although we weren't too aware of what unification was going to mean as far as budgeting and equipment and that sort of thing was concerned. We were mainly concerned with the fact that they called it integration, but it was going to be unification, and we knew that. Mm-hmm. And it was the loss of the individual services that were bothering people.
Mm-hmm. Would you say, from your perspective at the time, too, bearing in mind you had attained rank of lieutenant commander, with all the grumbling going on at the upper levels, and there was a few noteworthy incidents with certain admirals, that must have had a bearing on the lower decks.
Sure it did.
Yeah. Yeah. Could you, from your perspective, from your position, could you see that actually occurring?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Sure, it rubbed off on the people in the lower ranks.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, again, from your position, that would be fairly depressing.
That's right. And, some of the admirals were pretty vocal about their feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And not for long, because they left the service. But,
I guess that would also make it difficult for someone such as yourself. On the one hand, you have to retain a certain loyalty to your senior officers. On the other hand, you have your own personal feelings. Obviously, you were not too thrilled with what was going on. And I guess it's sort of you get to almost a catch-22 situation.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Mill, we're reaching the end here. So, on behalf of myself and the Future Department at the Exec, I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to chat with us and to talk about your career.
Well, I've been delighted. I'm sure that you'll find a lot of people that are a lot more interesting. I have more interesting backgrounds than I, but I've enjoyed it, and I hope that it's of some value to you.
Great. Thank you very much.